So we will turn to the next portion of the agenda, which is a detailed walkthrough of how to write a shadow report. And this portion will be led by Amy Berquist of the Advocates for Human Rights, and will be accompanied by Colette Pichon-Battle. Amy Berquist is a staff attorney in the International Justice Program at the Advocates for Human Rights. In this capacity, Amy works to advance justice through projects related to post-conflict peace building and rule of law. Amy is currently a member of the Minnesota Judicial Branch's Committee for Equality and Justice, and she's also a member of the USHR and ICCR Task Force. Our other presenter with Amy is Colette Pichon-Battle. Colette is an attorney and the director of the Gulf Coast Center for Law and Policy, which is based in Slidell, Louisiana, where she manages programs focused on global migration, community economic development, climate justice, and disaster assistance. She develops regional and state advocacy initiatives, manages and provides legal campaign-based services, and oversees trainings for local community leaders on issues that intersect with race, systems of power, and ecology. This is Colette's first time engaging with the ICCR voting process and has graciously agreed to serve as a case model for demonstrating this 10-step guide to writing a shadow report. So, Amy, if you will go ahead.
Sure. Thanks very much for that introduction. I'm Amy Berquist. And Colette, are you there? I can see that you're an audio participant now, but I don't know whether you're able to speak yet.
She is.
Me?
That's great.
Okay.
So Colette and I are here, and Colette has generously volunteered to be the guinea pig to see what this process is like of going through the different steps of writing a shadow report. So, and Colette and I have spoken only briefly, and Colette, can you verify for me? I feel like I'm doing a little car talk thing. Have you ever participated in any United Nations procedure or done any shadow reporting before?
Never. This is my first time.
Okay. So Colette is brand new to the process, and so she and I will be working through this sort of a coaching session as we go through the 10 steps to writing a shadow report. And if you're following along online, you'll see the PowerPoint. Even if you're not online, if you have in hand the 10 steps to writing a shadow report handout that was distributed via email this afternoon, you can follow along with that, and I don't think you'll miss any content. You might miss a few pretty pictures, though. So we'll get started so that we can leave enough time for questions. We're going to go through the 10 steps. The 10 steps are broken up into three different categories, as you can see in the handout. The first four steps are sort of setting the stage, getting sort of the relevant background to think about what your issues are in a rights context, in the context of human rights. Then steps 5 through 7 are about planning and gathering information. And then the last three steps, 8 through 10, are about implementing your plan, writing your report, and doing the advocacy around it. So those are the steps that we would suggest. And we're going to do this case study approach. So Colette is our case study, and then we'll, of course, hope to leave lots of time for questions that all other members of the task force can help answer as well. So that's our plan for this part of the presentation, and we'll get going on that. So we're at step one, and what you would do at step one is, first of all, identify what your expertise is. So what are the issues that you are concerned about or passionate about? What are your goals when you do advocacy? And what are your resources? Who do you have who might be able to help you with this shadow reporting process? What can they do? What kind of skills do they have? And then also a piece of advice is to enlist people to help as soon as you can, because it's reassuring to have people who are on board to help you. So Colette, tell us a little bit about who you are, what your issues are as they might relate to this process with the Human Rights Committee, and what your goals are.
Sure. So as Yolande said, I'm with the Gulf Coast Center for Law and Policy here in Louisiana, but we work regionally through the Gulf Coast, and we work specifically with communities of color. And our work focuses on the intersection of race and migration. So the immigration reform debate that's going on right now really has us concerned, and we want to bring a human rights and a racial justice lens to the proposed laws. A crucial part of our work requires us to examine how the immigration laws impact not only immigrants, but also Native communities of color. So we have some concerns that the militarization that's going on now is not only going to impact immigrant communities, but will also impact especially African-American communities within the reach of the federal laws.
So Colette, if I'm understanding you correctly, your primary focus or concern is the legislation that's before the Congress right now, that pending legislation. Okay, great. So Colette has identified a really specific focus and has talked a bit about why she and her organization have some expertise to shed some light on the human rights issues that are intertwined with that bill. And I think, in my mind, the phrase shadow report is sort of a misnomer. I like to refer to these reports are really shedding light. They're like flashlights because they shed light on things where there is no light in the U.S. government's report or there's very little light, things may be swept under the rug or ignored, and one thing your shadow report can do is really highlight or shed light on things that are important to you to raise awareness about those issues and help educate the human rights experts in Geneva, educate our own government, and educate your communities and the general public about what your issues of expertise are and what your issues are and what needs to be done to address them. So Colette, what about your resources? Do you have people who could help you do a shadow report? And if so, in what capacity?
Yes, well, we have some, all of our board members are actually attorneys in the region, and so we think we've got some great writers and researchers on staff and sort of within our organization. But we also belong to a number of other national alliances, including the Rights Working Group and the Alliance for Justice, and we have some national partners as well we think we can call on.
Great. So that's fantastic. And Colette, can you talk a little bit about? I think you had mentioned you or your organization had gone through a thought process about whether you wanted to participate in a joint report with other organizations or whether you wanted to do a report on your own to focus on your own particular issues. And what's your thought process there?
Yeah, well, we've been watching in the immigration reform debate a lot of organizations that work around the southern southwestern border really sort of come together around the militarization. I think what has been missing is the rest of the border states around the U.S. that will also be impacted by a number of provisions in the law. And so I think it would be a really great opportunity for us to really look at not only what's coming up from the Southwest, but also what it looks like in the Southeast. I'm in Louisiana, and the border, we are part of the border. We don't get talked about in the conversation. So I think it could be a really powerful alliance to pull all the border states together and maybe some of the alliances working within that.
That's great, and that's some great thing. Those are great things to be thinking about at this stage in terms of identifying your expertise, and it leads us into the next step, which is identifying your allies. And Colette, you already talked about these national alliances that you're a part of and talking about collaborating with other with the South, the Southwest and Southeast borders. And so it sounds as though you've identified some allied organizations. And are there any sort of subject matter experts who aren't part of those organizations that might also lend a hand or review a draft of the report? Anyone else you have in mind?
Well, we have some really great relationships with some colleges and universities here that have been all doing research and reports with community since Katrina. So, they've established some good credibility, but I think we would maybe use some of those folks to help us with the heavy lifting of the, grammar and editing and things like that. I think they'd be very helpful.
Fantastic. That's great. Great thinking. And then another thing you may want to think about is whether there are other allies that you can bring on, for example, networks that you could be a part of, like the U.S. Human Rights Network, that might provide some training about how to do shadow reports, for example, or offer you other guidance as you go along in the process. And do you feel like you're connected with any other people who could provide you with some technical tips or other information as you're going through the process?
Yeah, well, I now have Yolande's cell phone number, so I think I could get the U.S. Human Rights Network whenever I need them.
That's wonderful. Great. So I also want to say that there's power in numbers. So you can be more powerful by first of all, collaborating with other organizations on a single report that generally has more sway with the committee, and also power in numbers in terms of what the U.S. Human Rights Network can do, for example, by which the network will compile dozens of shadow reports into one single compilation that's organized in a way that's familiar to the committee and makes it easier. So those are two different ways to gain power in numbers in terms of how you approach the shadow reporting process. But you're certainly welcome to do it on your own as well. But think about whether it makes sense for you or your organization to join together with other organizations in some way as you approach the shadow reporting process.
Great.
Anything else from you, Colette, on step two, identifying allies?
No, I think we're good there.
Okay, fantastic. Now let's move on to step three, which is identifying the rights. And if you're not, if you haven't dealt with human rights treaties before, this may seem a little bit scary, but it's not that bad. And for this particular review process, as I'm sure you've heard, we're dealing with the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And one thing that's helpful to do early on is just go through the covenant itself, or the U.S. Human Rights Network has compiled sort of a simplified version of the covenant to see what are the relevant articles that sort of touch on the issues that you care about. So sort of comb through them, and I typically just copy and paste onto a separate document the articles that I think I'm going to home in on in my report so that I have them separate and I can always be sort of using them as a point of reference. And one article that I think some people tend to overlook but is really important for a lot of different issues, it's sort of a cross-cutting article, which is Article 2, Paragraph 1. And what it sees, if you're on the PowerPoint, you can see the text, and I'll read it for those of you who aren't on the PowerPoint. It says, each state party undertakes to ensure the rights recognized in the covenant without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin, property, birth, or other status. So the other parts of the covenant talk about specific rights like freedom of religion and the right to assemble. But what this says is that to the extent that the government is responsible for those rights, they have to protect and promote those rights in a non-discriminatory way. So, Colette, with that in mind, have you had a chance to take a look at any of the articles in the ICCPR to see whether they might be relevant to the issues that you're interested in?
Well, I was only able to look at some of the titles, and I think for sure that we're dealing, from our point of view, we're dealing with some blatant racial discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're also dealing with some privacy rights and other civil liberties. I'm not exactly sure how they would be mentioned in the international treaty, but we think that there's going to be just major race discrimination here for sure.
Mm-hmm. And if you're looking at discrimination for the ICCPR, you have this Article 2.1, and another article that hones in on that issue is Article 26, which again reinforces all persons are equal before the law and entitled without any discrimination to the equal protection of the law, and the law shall prohibit discrimination and guarantee equal and effective protection against discrimination on a variety of enumerated grounds. So Article 2, Paragraph 1 and Article 26 are going to be very important. Colette, can you talk about what you mean by privacy and why that would be relevant to what you are concerned about in terms of border communities?
Sure. So the proposed immigration legislation expands the enforcement of it violates privacy and other civil liberties by mandating the use of wartime surveillance tools and techniques. And what I mean by that is it literally mandates the use of drones. It also extends the range of some of the borders from 25 to 100 miles, meaning the patrol of the law enforcement officers has been extended, and it also allows for an extension of warrantless access to private lands, meaning the Border Patrol doesn't have to have a warrant to come into your house if you live within 25 miles of the border. And we think this is going to have serious violations of the drones for sure, just because it's an uptick in surveillance, but also the law enforcement just being able to walk into your own private property is going to be a problem.
Okay, so that makes a lot of sense. That the and Article 17 of the covenant talks about no one shall be subjected to arbitrary or unlawful interference with his or her privacy. So that's another article that would be relevant to the shadow report that Colette will be working on. And there may be other articles that, as Colette goes through the process, she would also identify as being relevant in other aspects, so other related issues that they're raising. So we've gone through, very briefly, of course, and all of you will be looking at different articles depending on what your issues are, but that's a little bit of a sense of what that process is like. And now we'll dig in a little deeper to see where we are to sort of situate ourselves in the ICCPR process. And so here you'll want to read up on what's happened so far as it relates to these rights. And Jamil talked about sort of where we are in the process already, but now it's the time for you, with your issues in mind, with your particular rights in mind, to look at what's been said about those rights so far in the U.S. review process. And you may want to go back as far as 2006, which was the last time the committee reviewed the U.S. performance under the treaty, to see whether anything was said there. And then you'll definitely want to take a look at the report the U.S. government submitted, look at the list of issues in the U.S. government response that Jamil talked about. And some of these are very long documents, and so don't be afraid to use a Control-F search mechanism to see if you find some key terms to zero in on the text that is relevant to you. Also, you'll note that the U.S. government report is organized by article. So once you've sort of situated, these particular articles are important, go through the U.S. government response on those particular articles to see whether your issue is raised. And as Jamil suggested, don't worry if your issue hasn't come up directly in any of these steps in the process. Everything is still on the table. And so there's nothing prohibiting you from jumping in to say, hold on, this is something that hasn't been addressed, it needs to be addressed, we would like the committee to take a look at this issue, ask the U.S. government delegation questions about it, and include recommendations on this particular human rights issue. So I apologize, Colette, because I know you're entirely new to the process, and as I said, these are very long documents. So did you get a chance to take a look at anything in any of those documents to see whether anything related to your issue was highlighted?
Yeah, so I think I was looking at the last response, and what I was able to see was that they had some mention of unwarranted racial disparities in some aspects of the justice system, and for the purposes of our work intersecting, with migration and these communities of color, we are not only concerned about what is clearly some racial disparities within the immigration system, but we're also looking at the intersection of racial profiling within the domestic population. And so we see these unwarranted racial disparities happening in all of our prison systems, so federal and state prison systems. And we think that there's a connection there, and we think that will increase with this increased criminalization of the borders. I also had a chance to look at some specific references to immigration. So they were talking about training for Border Patrol and just other aspects of, I guess someone had complained about Border Patrol before. So it looks like they were responding to what they were trying to do to get those folks, less hostile toward the folks that they were supposed to be patrolling. It looks like they needed training or some sort of understanding of what they were supposed to do. They also make some reference to activities at the U.S.-Mexico border. And, of course, in the current immigration law, what they're talking about is massive amounts of troops or, I'm sorry, of agents along that U.S.-Mexico border, and they're specifically looking to hire former military personnel. And so just looking at the response, it looks like they're talking about government officers and agents who abuse their authority. So that was something that that I also just saw briefly.
Great, great. And do you get a sense in terms of militarization of the border, do you get a sense that this is an issue that the Human Rights Committee is concerned about with respect to the United States?
Yeah, I don't see the word militarization, but I feel like that's maybe where they're leaning. Certainly it looks like that's where some groups have complained before. So I don't see them use that word, but that's the word we would use.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you go back to the 2006 review, the committee at the end of that process issued concluding observations, and one of the concluding observations that you might want to take a look at, Colette, is paragraph 27, and it says, I won't read all of it, but it says, while noting the information provided by the delegation that National Guard troops will not engage in direct law enforcement duties in the apprehension or detention of aliens, the committee remains concerned about the increased level of militarization on the southwest border with Mexico. Mm-hmm. So that's back in 2006. It was something that was of concern to the committee then, and one of the things, the way you could frame or think about framing your shadow report is to say the committee was concerned about this since 2006, and where we are in 2013 is it's actually the U.S. government is expanding the militarization. It's no longer only in the Southwest. It's both expanding in terms of the geographical scope from 25 to 100 miles, but also it's applying in the Southeast part of the United States as well. And so that might be sort of a lead-in to give the committee context to say, remember back in 2006, you were concerned about this, and now here we are, and here's the update. Things aren't getting better. In fact, they're getting worse, and here's this legislation that's going to aggravate these problems and create new problems. So that's one example of the way you can sort of place your issues in the context of what's been going on with the committee so far. Does that make sense to you, Colette?
It does, and it also made me, you know, realize that in the legislation they're specifically going around that. So they're actually giving authority to the use of the National Guard in immigration enforcement. So it does make me want to go back and really look at what was submitted so long ago, because it doesn't look like it was addressed properly with this legislation.
Yeah, and this is the sort of task that you can divide up if you have multiple people. You can have one person comb through one document and another person comb through another document, and then get your heads together to see sort of where you are and what's been said in the various documents. All right, let's move on now. We've done setting the stage, and now we're going to move on to planning and gathering information. So we're at step five. And step five is a chance for you to take a step back and clarify your role in light of what's gone on so far in this UN process. You have the knowledge and expertise that can help shed more light on the rights that you've identified and the related issues. So you might have on-the-ground information. You might be working in a community that's directly affected. You might have firsthand accounts from people whose human rights are violated, or people who have witnessed human rights violations, or service providers. Your organization might have written reports about the issue. Or you might have other specialized knowledge or other information that you think it would be useful to give to the committee so the committee can better understand what's going on the ground. So, Colette, talk to me about you and your organization, and how can you shed more light on the rights that are under review and the issues that are going on as it relates to those rights in the United States?
Well, you know, because we're talking about this proposed legislation, I don't have any direct information on what would happen if it passed. But what we can establish is that we already see discriminatory policing where we are in the Gulf Coast, which is within the range of Immigration Border Patrol. And we do legal clinics where we collect data, and we also have a consortium of folks who pool this data together, so we can see regional data of who's getting pulled over, usually by domestic police, but then turned over to federal policing, and who gets released, actually. And it's generally people of a certain hue who are detained, and those not of that hue who are released. So we also have some firsthand accounts, because we have these folks who have been caught up in this web. We have access to them. There are a few folks that we've actually gotten video interviews of, not specifically on this issue, but I think we could still reach out to them and maybe either refine some of those questions to get them to hit this point directly, or to just use that as some general statements. We haven't done any reports. We don't have that kind of capacity, but there are some reports done for our state around racial profiling. But we do have specialized knowledge in immigration law and in immigration enforcement, and we also have knowledge about the Department of Justice looking into not only our local ICE office, but also our local jails that have problems with racial discrimination as, you know, determined by the federal government through probes.
Great. It sounds like you have a lot to add to the process, a lot of things that you could incorporate into your shadow report. And the committee really does appreciate that firsthand information. They want to know what's going on the ground. They don't want sort of they want to look beyond the glossy covered U.S. government report, and they want to hear from civil society organizations about what they see on the ground. So it sounds like, Colette, you have access to a lot of great information that would help. And another thing, because your issue concerns pending legislation, you can do sort of simple legal analysis to say that this proposed bill mandates the use of drones, and then just use a footnote to cite to that particular part of the legislation, and that's information that isn't the committee doesn't know about yet. So getting that information, you don't have to do a lot of, you know, additional work. You just need to tell the committee this is what's in the works for immigration reform, so that if the U.S. government delegation is there saying how wonderful the proposed immigration reform bill is, the committee members can say, well, you say it's wonderful, but we understand that it actually would mandate the use of drones, invade privacy of communities in border regions, do so in a discriminatory manner, and so on. And so the committee members can help keep the U.S. government delegation honest.
Okay. Great.
So I think you've done a great job of clarifying your role and things that you can do to help help educate the committee about human rights conditions on the ground. So now we'll go on to step six and see what you want to get out of the committee's review. Now, in October, the U.S. delegation is going to appear before the committee, and the committee members are experts about the articles of the ICCPR. They're experts about what those rights are, what they mean. What do you want the committee to say on your behalf about the issues that you care about? What they might ask questions of the U.S. delegation, or they do ask questions, but they could ask questions about your issues. What kind of questions do you wish that they would ask, and what kind of recommendations do you think they should make to the United States government on those issues?
Well, first, I think it would be a really good opportunity for the United States to have to answer specific questions about such a large immigration bill. I think there are a lot of members throughout the U.S. who haven't really figured out how to, you know, digest all of the things within it. So I think it would be really great to just have some specific questions about the specific pieces. But in a more targeted way, it would be really great to have my country answer questions about racial disparities and racial targeting, whether they can defend the fact that one piece of the legislation says to criminalize the border crossing only at Tucson, Arizona, literally meaning an administrative violation of, you know, being in the country without lawful status or entering unlawfully. That is now going to become a criminal act, but only in one place. And a lot of the mandating of drones and extra surveillance is happening only at one area of the border. There's some violations, I think, also happening at the northern border and also in the southeast. But the words in the legislation really sort of hone into one type of immigrant, as though the United States doesn't have immigrants from around the world who look like something other than Latino. And I would like to hear answers to how they can defend that kind of distinction, which I would call a racial distinction, racial discrimination. I'd also like to see any conclusions from the UN about how to where the U.S. government should go to make sure that they're not violating human rights, perhaps giving some credibility to, I think, organizations that are going to contemplate litigation, you know, maybe having some conclusions from this body so that they can take into a court of law. Or at least have our government say, you know, this is violating a particular area of either our constitution or our principles as a country.
Great. And do you see, Colette, that there would be any recommendations the committee members could make about the legislation that's pending before Congress about, like, should they be encouraging the U.S. government to eliminate certain provisions of that legislation before it gets adopted?
For sure. I'm sure that, you know, I don't know how radical I expect this committee to be, but I think the part of this legislation that is incentivizing the criminalization of people of color is what I hope they would recommend that the U.S. really sort of rethink and reassess. The doubling of the border agents, that's a piece of the legislation at a time when we don't actually need doubling of border agents. We have, you know, the highest deportation and the lowest number of crossings in a long time. They're also requesting a 90% effectiveness rate of apprehension at the border. And this is something that, you know, they have to show that they can do this before the benefits are going to flow to millions of people who are unlawfully here. And so, you know, I would love for there to be some real specific recommendations around the Title I of this legislation, which is really, in my opinion, a criminalization of people coming from Central or South America and who have, you know, darker skin versus those from coming in from other places.
Okay, great. And it's great to be as specific as you can about the recommendations you'd like the committee to make to really give them guidance about where they should head as they're looking at these human rights issues. So it's great that you've been so thoughtful about that, Colette. Okay, let's move on to step seven. And step seven is designed to sort of connect step five, clarifying your role and how you can shed more light on the rights and the issues, with step six, what your goals are for the committee. So you're going to take your expertise and package it in, think about how to package it in a way that will persuade the committee to ask the particular questions you want it to ask and to make recommendations that you think would be most useful. So you're going to think about how you can gather information. It sounds like, Colette, you already have some data that you've gathered. You already have some testimonials and other information. And maybe you have time and the capacity to go out and get more information, or maybe you're just going to take the information that you already have and pull that together. What are your thoughts about that? Do you need to go out and get more information, or do you have everything at hand?
I think we may need to do a little bit more sifting of the resources that we do have at hand. I think we might have to get that team together to go through to make sure that we're identifying, you know, sort of all of these relevant connections.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have a question. When you were saying we could get them to ask particular questions, can we submit questions for them to ask?
Definitely can and should submit proposed questions for the committee to ask. Now, that, of course, doesn't guarantee that they'll ask them. There are only 6 hours total in the review, and there are a lot of things for the committee to cover. But giving them a carefully formulated question for the committee to ask is one way to make it easier on the experts on the committee, make it easier for them to highlight your issues. So that's one way you can frame the issues, is framing it in the form of certain questions they could ask.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, and another thing you can do at this stage when you're thinking about gathering information and actually doing the gathering of information is turn back to the allies that you identified in step two. Do your allies have information that they could feed to you that you could incorporate in the report? So that's another thing that you can do to help strengthen the report that you write. And then another thing you can do at step seven is to think about how you're going to use the report beyond the United Nations review. Beyond this Human Rights Committee review process, you may want to use the report to do education and mobilization in your community. You may want to use it to do lobbying in the future. You may want to use it to create greater awareness about the issues. And so it's not just for this particular UN procedure that you could use the report. You could use it in a lot of other contexts, and you can start planning how you're going to do that. So one example would be the September 23rd Day of Action that Jamil talked about. That could be another way you use that day of action to highlight your issues in your community with your stakeholders or with other people. So do you have any ideas about how you might use this report, Colette, in other contexts?
Yeah, we've been engaged in lobbying with the Comprehensive Immigration Reform, and now the bill is it has passed the Senate, and it is now in the House, and so there are hearings and ways to submit testimony, and I think if we put this together, we could literally submit probably the whole document as a form of testimony around some of the issues and challenges that we see. I also think we could use it in the community. Again, our work is, you know, not only looking at these laws to dismantle the structural racism within them, but it is also to help build alliances among the African American community and all immigrants of color. And so I think an education tool would be to show how, you know, this new law is criminalizing people of color, to show them that there is an intersection in the systems that they're both being caught up in, that these communities are both being caught up in, and maybe use some of the points as either tools for discussion with among the community, or even action items for the community to come together around.
That's fantastic. That's great that you're already thinking about this at such an early stage in the process. Great. So now we'll move on to the implementation stage. And the next step is the one that can be really time-consuming but also very rewarding, is writing the report. So set up your report writing team. Take the information that you've pulled together from steps 3, 4, and 7, and write the report. Now, you received a template via email, and you can follow that, but I'll say that each organization that does shadow reports does their shadow reports a little bit differently. So don't sweat it if you adopt a different format. Definitely the format for that's in the template will work, but if you want or need to do things a little bit differently, that's fine. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about the formatting. Focus more on the substance of what you're putting before the committee. And think about the audience for your report. Now, the primary audience for the report itself is the Human Rights Committee, and those are people who are experts on the treaty, on the treaty language. So you probably don't need to quote at great length the actual language of the articles. They know those articles backwards and forwards. So you can use a certain amount of shorthand in referencing those articles, but what they aren't experts about is the information going on the ground. So feel free to explain that to them. And include footnotes for them. So if you're making the claim that the Senate Immigration Reform Bill mandates the use of drones, you can say that and then put a footnote to cite the particular part of the bill that says that, just in case they get into some discussion with the U.S. delegation. The U.S. delegation says, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. There's no such provision. And the committee members can come back and say, well, we understand that it's actually in Section 1 of the bill, Subpart A, et cetera, et cetera. So that's your initial audience, but as we talked about in the previous step, in step 7, you also have a broader audience for the other uses of your report. So you might want to include a bit of extra language about those articles, because the communities you're dealing with when you do advocacy with the report and public education and outreach, they might not be familiar with these articles. So you might want to still throw in some of that language, even though the experts on the committee will just sort of skim over it because they already know what those articles say. So those are things to think about. And as we talked about before, you can incorporate in your report proposed questions and recommendations, the ones you thought about at step 6. And another provision, and we'll just say that this just to remind everyone, is one of the rules of the committee is don't use abusive language. These are experts, and they operate in sort of a formalistic way, and so they don't want incendiary language. They want you to remain as sort of professional as you can, even if you're very passionate about your issues. Frame it in a way that that the committee members can use and can treat as credible information, because it's not resorting to inflammatory language to make a point. So that's the report writing process.
I'll use one of my nice friends to help edit the last,
and it's great because, you know, if you are passionate, as I know you are, Colette, you can put everything on paper and then have somebody else take a look at it and you know, reframe it, tone it down a little bit if it needs toning down, and then by the time you're ready to submit it, it will be, you know, carefully crafted and worded so that the committee members will accept it as a credible submission from a civil society organization. So that's the great thing about the writing process, is that you can work toward that. You can sort of vent on paper and then let your words be refined in a way that will be sort of what the committee expects to see in a shadow report.
Okay.
Any questions about the report writing process or any thoughts that you're having, Colette, as you think about that?
How long are we thinking? Is there a maximum length it should be, or a minimum?
That's an excellent question. And the templates that suggest that your report should be 3 to 4 pages, and so that might not be enough space for you to cover your issues, especially if the issues haven't been addressed so far in the process. Like the immigration legislation is relatively new, so it's not addressed specifically in the U.S. government's report. So you may need to spend some additional time giving some background that the committee doesn't already have. If it's something that's already been addressed in the U.S. government report, in a list of issues, in the U.S. government's response, then the committee's already up to speed on the issue, and you can just jump in with your flashlight to shed light on the additional things that haven't been sufficiently covered, or to elucidate on particular points that you think are particularly salient. So those are, it sort of depends on what the context is, whether you need to go longer or shorter, and it also depends on how many issues you want to take on. So what are your thoughts about that, Colette, in terms of the length of your report?
Well, I'm thinking, because this is going to be our first time, that maybe we should try to get a solid report about 1 or 2 points so that we can stick to the 3 to 4 pages and maybe offer. What I don't think is going to be clear is that if I'm talking about the immigration bill, what might not be as clear to the committee is that we see that there's an intersection also with domestic laws, right? So the mass incarceration of African Americans is intersecting this immigration bill. I think we may have to offer a little bit of background on that. So we'll use our space to make 1 or 2 points about the criminalization of people of color, and then maybe offer some background information on the realities in some border states that are not being talked about.
That's great. And don't be afraid to just stick to a couple of issues that are sort of solidly within your issues of concern and your comfort zone. You don't have to take on the world. There are a lot of different organizations working on a lot of different issues. And so especially for people who are doing this for the first time, it can mean it's a lot more straightforward if you narrow your focus. And that's fine to do. It's fine to go broad as well. It just, can be more challenging as you're putting together the report. But it's a good thing to think about as you're approaching the process, and it obviously can be a bit faster to write a shorter report too. Anything else that you want to share, Colette, about what you're thinking about in terms of writing the report?
No, I'm just thinking to give myself enough time to do a few drafts. Mm-hmm. But the steps make sense.
Great. Okay, well, let's go on to step 9. We're getting close to the end here, and that's finalizing and submitting your report. Now we've talked about some of the deadlines. The absolute deadline for getting your report to the committee is September 13th, 2013. Now, the committee is in Geneva, so you need to allow extra time for those hard copies to get there, because they don't specify that they accept email submissions. So allow for that extra time to get things there. And optionally, of course, if you want to submit to the U.S. Human Rights Network, then the network will submit for you, but you need to get it to the U.S. Human Rights Network by August 23rd so that the network has time to compile it with all of the other shadow reports it will be receiving. Another thing you can do once you have your draft is recruit sign-ons. And what that means is just finding other organizations that care about your issue, send them a draft, and ask them whether they will sign on to your report, and then you can include their names on the report so that, again, that's tying back to the strength in numbers piece. So those are some other things. And circulating drafts to other stakeholders to get their review and comment is also really helpful. I think it's great, Colette, that you're thinking you want to go through several drafts, getting feedback from other people, from your board members, from professors, people in academia. Those are all great things to think about if you can allow the time to do that before the report is due. So any questions about that finalization process?
No. Is there, when you get sign-ons, are we just trying to get as many as we can? Yeah, it just looks better?
I think generally it looks better. Maybe there are some other members of the task force who would differ with me, but generally it's a strength in numbers thing. And so it's not just your organization speaking, it's these other organizations agree with you. And there might be a revision process. You might have an organization saying, we agree with you, except for there's this one part here, and if you would reword it, then we'd agree with you. Or if you can add this sentence, then we'd agree with you. And so it may be a negotiation process as well.
Mm-hmm.
But you want to allow time for that to happen. And you know, if you don't want to change it, then you don't change it, and then you don't include them in your list. And that's fine, too. You know, if you're writing the report, you're in charge.
Okay.
And it's also good to give people a heads up that you're going to be doing a report and that you will be asking them whether they want to sign on so that they can allocate that time. You know, give them enough time to read through the report and decide whether they want to sign on.
Okay.
All right, so the report is finalized and submitted, and now we get to step 10, and that's advocating for your issue. So I think we've already talked, Colette, about some ways that you've thought about to do advocacy in your community and doing outreach. We've also talked about the September 23rd Day of Action, and then there's some outreach that you can do in the context of the United Nations review, in the context of the committee's review. So one form of advocacy is doing direct outreach with committee members. There are people who go to Geneva and do one-on-one meetings or small group meetings with committee members to talk through the issues that they've put into their shadow report. And there can be follow-up during the October process, and then advocacy also back home for implementation of the committee's recommendations. If the committee recommends things or expresses concern about things, then you can use the committee's language as a way to frame your advocacy with the federal, state, or local governments to say, look, the Human Rights Committee just noted concern about this, recommended that you do this, and so we are here as civil society also to follow up on that and press you to make changes. And promoting longer-term social justice in terms of using your report as a tool for education and outreach, I think Colette has already done a great job in thinking through how she might go about doing that. Anything else you want to add about advocacy plans that you might have, Colette?
No, I mean, I'm really excited about that part, actually. I know that this is about submitting it to the committee, but it also feels good as someone who's doing work on the ground to put some work into something that has multiple uses. That feels really good. So it makes me think about making sure that when I write this for the committee, but also keep in mind, you know, keeping in mind where it's going to go after that. So
great. Great. Well, that's step 10, and Colette, thank you so much for your willingness to be the guinea pig and go through these 10 steps. I think you'll all agree Colette did a great job, and we learned a lot from her in the process. So, Colette, thank you for that. And now I think we're moving on to questions. And Colette, if you want to respond to questions as well, I think that would be great. But I know we also have some members of the ICCPR task force on the line to help answer questions, and you all have heard me talking for quite a while, so I'm hoping the other task force members can jump in and answer questions too. So thank you all for your attention.